All right, let's call this meeting of the Senate Resources Committee to order. Please let the record reflect that it is 3:30 p.m. on Monday, May 3rd, 2021. Let the record also reflect that we have a quorum present today. Our Senator Stevens, Senator Von Inhofe is excused, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Keel, Senator Machicki will be joining us shortly, and myself, Senator Rivak. Senator Bishop is also conducting other state business currently. Staffing the committee today is Emma Torkelson, LIO moderator Nate Williams, and Christopher DeGrell from Records. Thank you all for your service to the committee. Please turn off your cell phones. Today's agenda consists of five items. I would like to welcome for the record Senator Machicki. First item today, we'll take up Eli Cyrus, the governor's appointee to the Big Game Commercial Services Board. Then we'll have a second hearing on SB 104, Geothermal Resources. We'll adopt the committee substitute, take public testimony, and then we'll look to the will of the committee. SB 85, Forest Land Use Plans, Timber Sales, which is the first hearing for invited and public testimony today. HB 115, Aquatic Farming and Hatchery Site Leases. This is a second hearing for public testimony, and we will probably look to the will of the committee for that as well. And lastly, SB 121, PFAS use and remediation, fire water safety, which we plan to hear today. Let's get started with Eli Cyrus, governor's appointee to the Big Game Commercial Services Board. This board licenses and regulates the activities of providers of commercial services to big game hunters in the interest of the state's wildlife resources. Mr. Cyrus was appointed to the private landholders restricted seat on February 17, 2021, and if confirmed, his term would expire March 1st, 2024. Mr. Cyrus, if you could please place yourself on the record and give us a brief 2 to 3 minute introduction, a little bit about your background, and why you're interested in serving whenever you're ready, sir.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Eli Cyrus from Cayenne. I submitted a letter last week, I believe, outlining the interest in the board, and I can briefly summarize it. You know, I saw an opening on the Big Game Commercial Services Board, and I noticed that a couple of positions on there have remained vacant. I'm 30 years old. I live in Cayenne. I'm a lifelong Alaskan. I'm also a pilot and fairly familiar with our region. Our region is Game Unit 23. I've been an avid hunter all my life, both sport hunting and subsistence hunting. As far as employment, I previously served as the chairman of NANA Development Corporation for 4 years. I'm a NANA Regional Corporation board member and also the president of the Native Village of Cayenne. For employment, I'm the city administrator for the city of Cayenne. I'm just interested in, you know, helping to protect our state's resources while also making it available for Alaskans. Not sure what else I can add on that, and welcome any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cyrus, and we certainly appreciate your willingness to serve. Are there any questions from committee members? Well, seeing no questions from committee members, I will just echo that as far as I understand, it can be difficult to fill this particular seat, and so again, we appreciate your willingness to serve. At this point, we'll open public testimony. Public testimony on Mr. Cyrus's service on the board is now open. I don't see any online. Is there?
No.
Okay, and of course there's none in the room currently, so we're going to close public testimony. Public testimony is now closed. Mr. Vice Chair, can I get a motion?
Yes. Chair Rivak, I move that the following named appointee for the Big Game Commercial Services Board be forwarded to a joint session of the legislature for consideration. Eli Cyrus of Kiana.
Are there objections? Seeing none, the motion passes. For the record, in accordance with AS 3905080, a signature on this report does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individuals during any further sessions. We will pass around the paperwork now, and while we're doing that, we'll get on to SB 104, the geothermal resources. We first heard this bill on April 9th. We need to adopt a committee substitute that made changes to the initial governor's bill just to conform to our legal drafting standards. So no real substantive changes. Again, just conforming to legal drafting standards by Ledge Legal. Then we can move on to recap the bill, take up amendments, and hopefully look to the will of the committee today. Can I get a motion, Senator, Mr. Vice Chair?
Certainly, Mr. Chair Rivak. I move to adopt a committee substitute for SB 104 version 32-GS1618/Bravo.
Thank you. Are there any objections? Okay, seeing none, the committee substitute for SB 104 version 32-GS1618/B has been adopted. We have the following folks online from the Department of Natural Resources for further questions if needed. We have Deputy Director Haley Payne of Oil and Gas, Sean Clifton, Policy and Program Specialist, Division of Oil and Gas, and Steve Masterman, State Geologist and Director, Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. Do we have any questions from members of the committee? All right, seeing none, we will open public testimony. Public testimony on SB 104 is now open. I don't see any testifiers in the room. Are there any online? All right, seeing none online, we'll close public testimony. I will ask if we, are there any amendments?
Mr. Chairman, I have a conceptual amendment. I move conceptual amendment number one.
Thank you. We have an amendment, conceptual amendment number one. I'll object for the purposes of discussion.
So it's actually just kind of a word change. This was requested by DNR after they reviewed the drafting changes to the CS, and it keeps the language consistent with how DNR presently operates. But what it does is on page one or page three, line 28, it deletes the word authorized and replaces it with the word approved.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. I'll go ahead and remove my objection. Do we have any other objections?
Question.
Yes, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think authorized appears in the paragraph above. Same usage or different issue we're solving here? Line 23.
We're going to take a brief at ease if we can. Oh, we,
the department maybe.
Yeah, we have.
It's different usage.
Who could somebody from the department, whoever it can answer that question?
Yes, this is Sean Clifton with the Department of Natural Resources Division of Oil and Gas, the Policy and Program Specialist. The difference between authorized and approved in our statutes and regulations is that we typically authorize permits, temporary surface use permits, whereas this the context of what we're discussing in Section 6 is unitization, and that involves an agreement to which the division or the department, rather, is a party to, and we approve those agreements, and we recommended that we keep the usage of approve to be consistent with how we use that term in statute and regulation.
So, Mr. Chairman, I guess just if the department could take a look at line 23 and see if that also needs to change, I have no objection to the substance of the amendment.
Mr. Clifton, are you prepared to answer that question?
Yes. I am pulling this up again now. Please give me half a second to review this here. Okay. All right. Yes. Thank you, Senator Keel's observation is correct. I would want authorized on line 23 of page 3 to also be replaced with approved, in addition to the one on line 28.
Can I restate my motion?
Thank you, Mr. Clifton. Yes, Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will restate my motion. I move conceptual amendment number one, page 3, line 23. Replace the word authorized with approve. Page 3, line 28, replace the word authorized with approved.
Okay, thank you. Are there objections? All right. Seeing none, amendment number one passes. Do we have further amendments? Okay, seeing no further amendments, do we have any other comments or questions from the committee members? Seeing none, Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move committee substitute for Senate Bill 104, version 32-GS1618, /Bravo, as conceptually amended, out of committee with the attached individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Thank you. Are there objections? Okay, seeing no objections, committee substitute for SB 104, version 32-GS1618, /B. With conceptual amendments, moves from committee. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. All right, we're back on the record, and now we're going to take up SB 85, Forest Land Use Plans, Timber Sales, and this is the first hearing. We have Brent Goodrum, Deputy Director of DNR, on the line to provide opening remarks. Next, we have Tim Dabney, Acting Director of Forestry, on the line to provide us with a presentation. Chris Orman from the Department of Law is on the line for questions as well. Mr. Dabney, if you're prepared and ready to go, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon. This is Deputy Commissioner Goodrum. Thank you, Chair Revac and committee members. For the record, it's great to be with you here today, and thank you for the opportunity to bring before you Senate Bill 85, a bill that seeks to help modernize our timber sales process and to make our decisional processes more consistent with contemporary practices. The proposed modifications to these statutes will help grow predictability and jobs in Alaska's timber industry, an industry that has longed for more flexible negotiated timber sales necessary to meet the current needs of their intended markets. The benefit of enacting Senate Bill 85 will result in more efficient land use planning and more predictable timber harvests. Who in business today doesn't rely upon predictability? Importantly, Senate Bill 85 has a zero fiscal note. As you mentioned, Chair Rivak, I am joined this afternoon by Tim Dabney, Acting State Forester, who will present Senate Bill 85 to you. Tim will also be joined by Chris Orman with the Department of Law, who will be able to assist with any legal questions related to this important legislation. Again, thank you for the opportunity to present Senate Bill 85. Mr. Dabney.
Thank you, Brent. Yeah, I think I jumped the gun there earlier on, so now it's Mr. Dabney's turn.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Tim Dabney, Acting Director for the Division of Forestry in the Department of Natural Resources and Acting State Forester. I have a PowerPoint that I'm going to go through. I trust that you have hard copies there, as I will navigate us through that. So going on to page two of the presentation, my presentation will cover the following. The issue is Southeast Alaska timber industry is struggling to survive. How can we provide and protect timber jobs? We need to change negotiated timber sale statutes to allow the local purchaser to sell all the timber it harvests as export if needed. We need to provide a stable and predictable supply of timber to the industry once a timber sale has been purchased. And then if the committee pleases, I can go into a sectional analysis further on into my presentation. Slide three. The U.S. Forest Service is not providing the supply of timber that the timber industry needs in Southeast Alaska. Back in the 1990s, there were some 4,000 timber industry jobs in Southeast Alaska. Now there are only about 325. Now even those jobs are in danger. Young growth or second growth forest in Southeast Alaska can become economically harvestable at about age 50 to 55 years. That means the industry will have to wait until about 2030 before there will be an adequate timber supply. In the meantime, the industry will struggle to survive. Next slide. I want to draw your attention to the inset map. Division of Forestry provides a sustainable yield of timber volume possible on state land, but that land base is tiny. The Southeast State Forest represents only 0.04% of the Southeast Alaska land base. If you look at the inset there, you'll see some dark spots. That's the Southeast State Forest, and you'll note that there are 32 scattered forest units totaling approximately 46,952 acres. By comparison, the Tungus National Forest is 16.8 million acres with about 5.5 million of those acres that are commercial timberland. Next slide, slide five. So how can we provide and protect jobs? Step one has to do with negotiated timber sales. We need to change negotiated timber sale statute to allow the industry to sell the timber it harvests as export if needed. Currently, the negotiated timber sales statutes prohibit our local timber purchasers from selling all logs for export. Most of these logs must be used for local manufacture. A changing timber supply to more young growth timber means that much of this timber is not marketable in Alaska. Excuse me. Additionally, for certain species such as hemlock, demand is only at overseas markets or in the Pacific Northwest. Next slide, slide six. There are two types of timber sales the Division of Forestry administers, the competitive type and negotiated type. Negotiated timber sales are important because they allow Division of Forestry to choose a timber purchaser not only based on the price it is willing to pay for the timber, but also on the number of local jobs the sale provides. So that's my presentation on negotiated timber sales. I'll pause before I go on to the next item if there are any questions.
Thank you. Yes, we have a question from Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you. Just for my information, you mentioned Hemlock has an overseas market, a Pacific Northwest. But just help me, what does Hemlock specialize use? What does it use for?
Through the chair, and was it Senator Kill?
Stevens.
Stevens, my apology. So that's a good question. The Hemlock it has a higher moisture content, and so it's not a good tree species for dimensional lumber. And so overseas, it is used for smaller items such as molding.
Okay, thanks very much. I appreciate that.
Any other questions? All right, please, sir, continue.
All right, on this slide, thank you, Tim Dabney, Division of Forestry. Slide seven, the second step to providing and protecting jobs is to provide a stable and predictable supply of timber to the industry. Once a timber sale has been sold, SB 85 would reduce appeals to ensure a stable and predictable supply of timber to the industry. Next slide, slide eight. So let me go through the steps in a timber sale, up to the timber sale offering an award. Public and agency comment is gathered at each of these four steps that I'm going to go through. And the agency's comment that we solicit are two regulatory agencies, the Department of Environmental Conservation and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. We also work with the State Historic Preservation Officer. The first step is regional planning. That's the area plans and the state forest plans. Secondly, each of our area offices do a five-year schedule of timber sales, and that's done every 2 years. And that goes out, that just identifies the sales that we're planning over the next 5 years and gives an opportunity for the public to provide input on those sales, those proposed sales. The third step is getting into the decision-making process on specific sales. Step is the best interest finding. What we do to solicit public and agency comment is we go out with a preliminary best interest finding, and we, as I mentioned, those agencies that I named before, we work very closely with them as well as the public, and we go out with the best interest finding, and timber can be sold after the best interest finding is adopted. The fourth step is the forest land use plan, and the forest use plans are done for timber harvest units. All forest land use plans don't have to be issued before timber is offered for sale. For large sales, it is efficient to prepare the forest land use plans in phases as access is created. And importantly, as part of the this presentation and the public process, the regional planning, the best interest planning, and the FLUPs are currently subject to a public appeal. On to slide nine. So the best interest finding, or the BIF, and the forest land use plan, or the FLUP. So what's the difference between those? It's very important to understand that the best interest finding is the decision document that answers the question, should we sell this timber? The forest land use plan implements that decision on the ground that determines how the timber will be harvested. On to slide 10. So we have the Alaska Forest Resources and Practices Act, FERPA, AS 4117, which protects fish habitat It protects water quality and ensures prompt reforestation. And that the best interest findings, the forest land use plans, and the timber harvest themselves must adhere to FERPA. Slide 11. An appeal on a purchased sale can halt harvesting, which can be disastrous to a logging company. SB 85 ensures that once the decision has been made to sell the timber and it has been sold, no further administrative appeals can occur. Slide 12, SB 85 focuses appeals at the best interest finding stage before the timber is sold. SB 85 is important because it provides stable and predictable supply of timber once it's sold, and no interruptions of the harvest at subsequent forest land use plan stages. That completes my presentation on the forest land use plan appeals step. Any questions on that before I proceed?
Any questions, Senator Machicki?
Yeah, Mr. Dabney, I understand the bill and support most of it, and I have one question about the being able to sell raw timber elsewhere where the market may be better. Part of that is kind of have a dream of someday when we can employ Alaskans creating Alaskan goods. Maybe that's Alaskan trim out of hemlock. Just wondering how we ever get there if we don't encourage one of these forestry companies to invest in the machinery it would take to employ a few dozen and export a proud finished product from Alaska instead of raw timber.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, thank you for that question. The forest land managers, including the state of Alaska, need the industry here as much as the industry needs the forest lands. And as you said, what we would be doing with our timber sales, including those that are exported, we would be using Alaska jobs and equipment to do that. And I certainly would be a strong advocate, as well as the department, to do whatever we can to keep our industry that we currently have alive long enough to be able to introduce new manufacturing opportunities, such as making these types of products that you could make out of hemlock and second growth, young growth.
Thank you, Mr. Dabney. This bill removes the requirement for local production of finished products. Doesn't say it can't be done, but does it not make it less likely?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, the removal of that part of the statute is not intended to remove that option. It just is removing that language so that it allows for export also. So certainly what was 115 would now be 118 negotiated sales would certainly allow for local purchasers and specifically the 123 section of the statute is uniquely for the local manufacturers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Stevens, then Senator Keel.
Thanks, Mr. Dabney. I know we're barely into this presentation, but will you be talking about reforestation, or is that a part of your presentation?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, no, sir. I would the only reforestation topic that I will be addressing today has already been addressed. That FERPA requires for regeneration following harvest. That's not part of the bill.
Well, maybe while we're talking about this, you could help me. Who does reforestation? Who pays for it? Who does the work?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, the land manager is responsible for the reforestation. In some parts of Alaska, reforestation is a natural process that doesn't require employees on the ground to plant trees. In other parts of the state, artificial reforestation through hand planting of seedlings is required to achieve reforestation.
Well, thank you. I won't belabor this. I appreciate your comments. But at some point, I'd like to know more about that. I mean, natural process doesn't work well on Kodiak, and there is artificial reforestation. So it seems to me that on state land, we want to make sure that it's producing timber as quickly as possible. So that's you don't need to go into further, Mr. Dabney, but maybe further at another time we can talk about that.
Thank you. Next we have Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question for I guess whoever at the department wants to answer it. It's about removing the ability for Alaskans to appeal a forest land use plan after the initial sale. And I guess the presentation says that DNR will continue to listen to the public comment and listen to other agencies, but there's nobody who can stop DNR if a Phase 5, Phase 6 forest land use plan is, as you say, when access is eventually created to the area in question. If the public doesn't think the state is meeting its obligations, how do we ensure that public comment or other agency comment stays meaningful?
Through the chair, Senator Keel. So let me address the agencies that are involved in adopting FLUPS, the forest land use plans. We give due deference. The Division of Forestry, DNR, gives due deference to Department of Environmental Conservation and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. They go out to these harvest units and review them and provide comment, and whatever comments that are within their purview, we and the Department of Natural Resources are bound to adhere to and comply to whatever they are requiring. So that's very important. And we also are required to adhere to the Alaska Forest Resource and Practices Act, as well as all of the other documents that preceded the forest land use plan, including the best interest planning and the area plans, all of which were subject to public comment and appeal. Specific to the public, we, as you say, we solicit public comment for our forest land use plans, and the Division of Forestry has an excellent track record of working with those public commenters to make changes as necessary to how the harvest is implemented. It may be, as an example, there may be a need to shift a boundary of one of the harvest units for visual impacts or for wind throw.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess one time I heard an Alaskan disagree about whether government had gotten it right. I can't remember when that was, but I think it happened. And I guess my concern is if there's no opportunity to appeal that, we may hear that a little more loudly in the future.
Do we have other questions, committee members? All right, seeing none, thank you for your presentation, Mr. Dabney. We're going to move on to public testimony. Public testimony is now open. I don't see anybody in the room here to testify. No, anybody online? All right, seeing no one here to testify, we'll close public testimony.
Yes, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Does anyone have a page 6 in their bill?
I have every other page.
I'm particularly interested in section 2, but we're going to hold this bill.
You're right. We're going to hold this bill for further review and consideration. So I want to thank the department for joining us today. Next, we're going to move on to HB 115, Aquatic Farming and Hatchery Site Leases. This is a second hearing. We first heard this bill on April 23rd. Today we'll take up public testimony and see if we can move the bill. We're going to go ahead and open public testimony. Okay, public testimony on HB 115 is now open. We have no one in the room to testify. Anybody online? Seeing no one online, we're going to close public testimony. Public testimony is now closed. We do have DNR Division of Mining, Land, and Water, Samantha Carroll, online for questions from committee members. Do we have any questions from members of the committee? All right, seeing none, I'd like to, Mr. Vice Chair.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the committee substitute for HB 115 version 32-LS0299/O out of committee with the attached individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Thank you. Is there an objection? All right, seeing no objections, the committee substitute for HB 115 version 32-LS0299/O moves from committee. We'll pass around the paperwork while we we'll take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. All right, we're back on the record. The next item on the agenda is SB 121, PFAS use and remediation, fire, water, safety. I'd like to invite Jesse Keel. Senator Keel, please put yourself on the record, provide your opening remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, Jesse Keel, representing Senate District Q, pleased to have you all sitting in it right now. Senate Bill 121 deals with what we generally call PFAS, perfluoro and polyfluoroalkyl substances. Mr. Chairman, they've been around a long time for two big reasons. One is they're really effective at what they do, especially firefighting. And the other is they don't break down. You can't get them out of the environment once they're out there. And so when I say PFAS has been around a long time, I mean both historically and unfortunately when present in the environment, people refer to them as forever chemicals. They also happen to be particularly bad for you. I won't run through the list of bodily systems that they're bad for. That's in the sponsor statement. but the bottom line is they're poisonous. A couple of years ago, the scientists and experts at Alaska's Department of Environmental Conservation were working on health protective standards for PFAS chemicals in our drinking water. The plug got pulled on that effort, and DEC was told to defer to the Environmental Protection Agency, which had standards only for two of the many, many, many PFAS chemicals. And those standards were very high. The state of Alaska needs to protect Alaskans' health, and especially when it comes to our drinking water, Mr. Chairman. So what Senate Bill 121 does is list the six of these chemicals about which we know the very most. And it sets good health protective standards for how much of them can be in drinking water before they are a danger to Alaskans. This is not a site cleanup standard, Mr. Chairman. This is just dealing with what Alaskans get out of their taps and out of their wells. Senate Bill 121 stops additional discharges of PFAS chemicals into the environment, except in those few situations where they are federally required. That, Mr. Chairman, is primarily at airports, although the federal government is due to end that requirement this October. For spills of PFAS chemicals into our environment here in Alaska, where drinking water might be impacted, Senate Bill 121 maintains Alaska's current system of dealing with poisoned drinking water. The polluter pays, and we go a step further. We also ensure that the polluter, the sprayer, will provide a blood test, for anyone whose drinking water has an over-the-limit amount of PFAS chemicals, or a first responder who was exposed to these chemicals when spraying them. There are a couple of other interesting elements in SB 121. There is an exception to the no more use rule for the oil and gas industry. The approach that the bill takes, Mr. Chairman, is to say that as soon as the state fire marshal certifies that there is an effective non-PFAS alternative, they will begin a regulation process so that industry is on notice and can transition over to the safer chemicals. This is a little bit different than what some other states have done. Other states have put in place an end date and a process for getting extensions. Senate Bill 121 takes a different approach. It is permissive until such time as there's something safer out there. It's important, Mr. Chairman, that we think about this public safety element. So I often think in an oil and gas state about a tanker terminal that has an awful lot of hydrocarbons that would burn incredibly hot. The simple fact is, to protect lives, we're going to need the best fire suppressant there is. Until there's a safer one, this bill would allow PFAS chemicals in the oil and gas industry. Couple of other elements worth noting. DEC, the state of Alaska, would take from Alaskans up to 25 gallons a year of PFAS-containing concentrates. Mr. Chairman, the state sent a lot of this stuff out to small villages in code red carts. Those villages don't have the funds for hazmat disposal. And so we don't want the state to become the recipient of all industrial PFAS everywhere in the state and every single airport's backstock of this stuff. But for our small villages, this is a necessary safety valve so that they're not faced with the colossal cost of the hazmat hazmat disposal. Mr. Chairman, there's a cost to this, and you'll note the fiscal note, which the department has worked very hard on. There are going to be costs, regardless of whether we pass this bill or not. I think this is the responsible approach. I would also note that the state of Alaska has joined into the long list of states who have filed suit against the manufacturers to help recover some of what's going to cost us to get Alaskans clean drinking water because these chemicals are in the environment. So, Mr. Chairman, that's the bill. I believe it's a balanced approach to end new PFAS contamination and to make sure that you get clean drinking water if this stuff contaminates what you're drinking today. With that, I will happily turn it back to the committee. I have staff who's prepared to go through section by section, or we can take questions as you like. There is also, I believe, two invited testifiers ready to speak, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Yes, I think you have Kathy here if you want to put yourself on the record and walk us through the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, this is Kathy Schlingheit, staff to Senator Keel. Section 1 of the bill creates five new sections in AS 4603. The first new section is the standards for clean drinking water and blood testing. Part A ensures that water in areas of spills needs to be tested, and if the water is contaminated, provide clean drinking water and blood tests for those with contaminated water. Subsection B sets the maximum levels of the PFAS compounds that can be in water. In drinking water. DEC can make these more protective as there's more data in this emerging field. Subsection C requires a voluntary blood test be provided for first responders who are exposed through their work. The second section deals with who pays. So this largely tracks DEC's current rules that the polluter pays. Subsection A makes clear the causer of the fire is liable for providing the drinking water and the blood testing, with an exemption for house fires and personal cars. Subsection B says that a fire department, as they are now, maintains liability if they have a spill from training or testing. And subsection C again reiterates that this follows DEC's existing rules. Subsection D is the definitions for the personal cars and for residential homes. The third section addresses who can still use PFAS-containing foams. Subsection A that says that the oil and gas industry may continue using these fluorinated foams. Subsection B establishes the process for the oil and gas industry to transition. The fire marshal can initiate that by regulation when the nationally recognized testing labs say that there is a safe fluorine-free alternative. Subsection C is where DEC needs to take up to 25 gallons per year for disposal from Alaskans of the PFAS-containing foam. And subsection D says that on October 4th, no fluorinated foam can be used unless you're in the oil and gas industry or there's a federal law that preempts Alaska law. And again, that date was set to when the FAA will stop requiring the use of the foam at airports. The fourth section added says that you need a major source permit under the Clean Air Act to use heat to try to destroy these compounds. It's very difficult to break that carbon-fluorine bond, but there's been some developments with that. Section 5 lists, again, the PFAS compounds that are covered by the bill, and again says DEC can add more compounds to this list as they get more data on the health effects from the various types of PFAS compounds. Section 2 of the bill is the applicability provisions. So Section 2A says that first responders are eligible for a blood test based off of exposure on or after January 1st of 2019. Section 2B clarifies that the requirements to test drinking water and provide clean drinking water and blood testing applies to both past and future PFAS contamination, which matches DEC's current rules. And sections 3 through 6 of the bill add the effective dates. Section 3, that DEC can adopt regulations immediately. Section 4 ties to that October 4th date to ban the use of fluorinated foams. Section 5 is the immediate effective date for applicability and transition, and Section 6 sets the effective date for the rest of the bill at January of 2022.
Thank you, Ms. Schlingheide. Do Do we have any questions from members of the committee?
Chairman?
Yes, Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, Senator, you well know that my district comes slightly into southeastern Alaska, including Yakutat, which has suffered enormous problems because of PFAS. I guess my question is sort of wide, on a wider view. How widespread is PFAS contamination in Alaska? Are there other locations? I know Yakutat is one. Can you tell us about the alternatives? Is there anything really on the horizon that will help out?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In answer to Senator Stevens' question, the contamination is extremely widespread. Just about every airport in the state, certainly every airport where you land a jet, has had, again, by federal requirement, has had these fluorinated firefighting foams sprayed there. Not every such airport has a source of drinking water nearby. And so the bill would not affect those situations. But near the Yakutat Airport, near the Gustavus Airport, Dillingham, several others that we know of. A few years ago, the legislature appropriated funding for DEC to go out and test additional areas. Unfortunately, Mr. Chairman, Senator Stevens, I believe they'll find significant additional drinking water contamination. In terms of what else is out there, there's quite a bit of promising technology for what they call fluorine-free foams. Much of the European Union requires those foams and does not allow any use of the PFAS-containing firefighting foams. There is also a great deal of research being done on new alternatives here in the United States. Our state fire marshal, I believe, has been involved with significant ongoing work and training for firefighters at the, I believe it's University of Texas, one of the Texas large institutions. I'll get the wrong one if I try and quote it to you. But is staying abreast of the developments in technology, and some of it is very promising.
Well, thank you. Senator, so we're really not at a position to require an alternative like chlorine, as you say. We're not there yet to be able to provide to require it.
Mr. Chairman, in answer to Senator Stevens, there are. I think it's important that to note that the Federal Aviation Administration is ending its requirement that this be on hand. The fluorinated foams be on hand for airports because there are other highly effective tools for fighting those fires. With regard to the oil and gas industry in particular, we worked with AOGA and several of their members. They were concerned about the quantities and the potential intensity of the fires in the work they do in our state. And so we put this carve out there. But I would note again that that many other countries are completely fluorine-free in their firefighting foams.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. We do have invited testimony here. We have two folks. We'll start with Kelly McLaughlin, and then we'll go on to John Kanish. Kelly, if you could please put yourself on the record and tell us who you're with and begin.
Hi, my name is Kelly McLaughlin. I am here representing the Gustavus PFAS Action Coalition, and I'm at home with a puppy and a four-year-old, so please excuse any potential interruptions. I hope they're otherwise occupied, but we'll see. So thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and Senators, for hearing my testimony today. I really would love to have you all out to Gustavus and start with a cup of coffee at my coffee shop. Then walk the plume, take a couple hours at least to cover all of this. But I'll try to put it together into 3 to 5 minutes and give you a rundown of what I've been through in the last 2.5 years. I first became aware of PFAS in August of 2018 when I received a letter from the DOT that said that the Gustavus School's water and several wells at the airport were contaminated with PFAS. I didn't know what it was at that point, but I immediately started researching, and I learned that there were a huge group of toxic chemicals, and I quickly found two things to be true. One was that these chemicals were everywhere and highly toxic, and two, there was not enough information or nearly enough protection from PFAS. like everything I had at that point was sort of stripped from me. My water was not safe to drink. The water at the school was not safe for my kids to drink. I have medicinal plants and garden vegetables and chickens, and all of that was suddenly in question. This bill is a step in the right direction for protecting the health of Alaskans and the wild places where we make our homes and hunt and harvest. It is just about drinking water, principally, but it's also about the effects that water has on everything it touches. So this is a start with the drinking water, but it goes so much further than that into everything that grows or drinks the water or eats the plants that grow near the water. It's imperative that AFFF no longer be used at airports across the state. Even a small amount of this stuff, one release, can catastrophically contaminate soils, the surface, and groundwater immediately adjacent and for miles around. It doesn't break down, and remediation is difficult. It will save the state money to be proactive today. Just ending the use of AFFF will save the state future contamination and future cleanup efforts. In order to ensure that Alaskans are drinking water levels must be lower than the current EPA guidance. It really lags behind. Many states are regulating PFAS as a class with a cap at around 20 parts per trillion total. So this bill doesn't regulate as a class. It has specific numbers for specific compounds. But other states are being even more proactive and regulating them. Like the fluorine carbon bond is what's being regulated, because there's every time I hear the number, it's bigger. But first there was 2,000, then 3,000, then 5,000. Last I heard, 8,000 different PFAS compounds. So there's an endless option for recreating these toxic PFAS compounds. The Gustavus PFAS Action Coalition has led and collaborated on testing in Gustavus. We've tested Gustavus local blood serum levels, local grown plants, livestock, wild foods, and fish and game. We've taken water samples in addition to what the state has done and worked with Indiana University and ACAT to correlate the PFAS levels in the water with the PFAS levels in the blood. There's a direct correlation. There is a marked effect on every plant, animal, and local resident where AFFF is used. One of the reasons that I choose to live in Gustavus is my ability to be self-sufficient here. I have chickens, like I said, and I'm getting goats. I have a dog, and we just adopted a puppy. But for every animal now that I choose to raise on my property, I have to consider the ethical question of knowingly contributing to their potential ill health. I ask you all to consider that question. This bill gives you the power to remedy what I call a mass poisoning of Alaskans. And I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thanks, Kelly. I think before we get to any questions, we'll move on to John Knish, PhD, retired professor of chemistry from the University of Alaska Anchorage. John, if you could please put yourself on the record and begin.
Yeah, I actually was invited to make a presentation to the committee by ACAT. I'm an analytical chemist who taught chemistry for 36 years, and in addition to that, the reason why they asked me to do this is because I actually had experience in the Oregon Health Sciences Center doing research on specific flame retardants, the ones that were used for children's pajamas. And the reason why these compounds work so well is they're halogenated hydrocarbons. And the reason that they stop fires so well is when they start to burn or they produce free radicals, and the free radicals react with the free radical oxygen radicals that are present, and they stop the fire almost dead in its tracks. So they're extremely effective at that particular application. The difficulty with them is they have a lot of other issues with regards to toxicity. I should explain toxicity here. I worked at DuPont, and so I was familiar with toxicity defined by LD50s, which is measuring how toxic something is and how many organisms die when exposed to the chemical and at what level that occurs. This is not what we're talking about with toxicity here. The toxicity here has to do with the actual response of human body, that is to the chemicals themselves, and it affects the genetic composition of our bodies as well as the immune system, and oftentimes they result in extreme cancer, extreme toxic effects that are associated with health issues. There's a long list of those, and I think that you have probably seen that on the report there that you've generated. I do want to say one thing in addition, and that is I have to give you compliments on everything you've done here. It's incredible to see the caliber of the of this particular bill, and I think it's really important that these things be applied to help the average Alaskan in terms of exposure and also dealing with the quality of the water that they drink. So if you have any other questions for me, I'd appreciate hearing them.
Thank you, Dr. Kanesh. Do we have any questions for either? We also have Sarah Yoder from DHSS, John Binder from, Deputy Commissioner of DOT, and Samantha Cummings, Program Coordinator from DOT, online for questions. Yes, Senator Stevens.
Well, maybe just a question of John. John, we've been hearing a lot of information here. We had a prior information from Kelly. Do you agree with her comment that this is a step in the right direction? Not the solution, but a step?
Through the chair, yes, I would like to say that that's absolutely the best thing that you could do at this time. I hate to tell you this, though, and that is these problems are long-lived, and they will probably take years to find a appropriate solution to the chemical structures in the replacement aspect of it. But I will say that I'm embarrassed as a chemist to say that it's ridiculous that states have to deal with this particular issue. It should have been dealt with years ago by the federal government or the actual manufacturers. So I'm sorry that you have to face this issue, and you really have to deal with your constituents, but it's a real problem. If you don't respond to the constituents, it will end up becoming a long-term difficult situation.
Thank you, John.
You're welcome.
Thank you. I have a quick question. What concentration of these chemicals, at what point do they become dangerous to humans?
That's an excellent question, and that question relates to the specific tests that people have actually done, the toxicology tests. And you have to understand, this is not, as I mentioned before, these are not LD50s or where a certain number of organisms die from exposure. These are tests that result from specific disease responses in organisms. Some kind of a reference animal might be used. Oftentimes it's rats or mice, things like that. And then there also are indirect evidence that are associated with human beings, how many people get cancers and so forth relative to the exposures and the level at which this occurs. These numbers that you're describing for this particular set of compounds is extreme. These are some of the lowest concentrations that I've ever seen with regards to contamination in the environment, and the effort to remove them is going to be extremely difficult because it's so low. So it's a real, real, real serious problem in terms of the response of the human cellular response to these kinds of materials.
Thank you, Dr. Kanesh. Any other questions? All right, seeing no more questions, thank you, Senator Keel, and staff. We appreciate you guys coming up to brief us today. Well done. We're going to hold this bill for further consideration. Our next meeting will be on Wednesday, May 5th, 2021, at which point we'll be hearing SB 133, remote recreational sites, sales, permits, and SB 134, master guide outfitter requirements. This meeting is now adjourned at 4:32 p.m.